All right. Well, now this is amazing. I'm incredibly nervous to talk to this guy because he is such a fascinating person, such an amazing man. Joining me now on the line, ladies and gentlemen, Steve Silberman. Steve, how are you, sir?
Hey, buddy. I'm actually nervous to talk to you because I'm not the kind of person who can remember what was played 602 shows ago or whatever the heck.
Yeah.
I love the music. I stay in the moment. But I'm not a sort of scholarly fishhead in the same way that some people are.
Oh, well,
and in fact, I believe there was just a big academic conference about the Grateful Dead somewhere that Jesse Jarnow went to, who is one of my favorite writers on the Dead. And just the subjects of the papers were intimidating to me.
Oh, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. There are people, and I'm surely not one of them as well, that like a good portion of their brain is committed to the music of the Dead and Fish, and not just the music, but the analytics, the dates, it's way beyond me. I'm with you, man.
Yep. Yeah, I was never, I completely respect, it's kind of amazing if you think about, do you know what Dead Base is or was or whatever?
Yeah.
You know what that is,
yeah.
Right? It's like a gigantic book that lists all the performances that the Dead ever did and all the venues that they ever played at and all
right.
the songs they ever played and the number of times they played them and the number of repeats at shows. People who have minds like that are fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And there are many of them in these communities that I have chosen to write about for most of my life.
Right.
But I am not one of those people.
Yeah.
I am not if I had been into baseball, which I wasn't, I would not have been a stats geek.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And so it is true that, that is a wonderful activity for people who love to do that. But for me, when I go to shows, it's kind of like, I like to forget who I am for a couple of hours
right.
and just to immerse myself in the music.
Yeah, when Fish is playing and, you know, I'm watching the Twitter feed because Fish Twitter is a world of its own. When you know, a particular bust out is played and like within seconds of that song starting to play, somebody's there with a stat, you know, last time played, blah, blah, blah. It's like, my God, how are you getting this information so fast? How do you know this so fast? It is truly fascinating.
That's certainly one thing we could talk about over time is that kind of the, you know, being a jam band fan has changed so much
right.
Over the course of my career as a fan of this music.
Right.
You know, I was just thinking, actually, when I was at the last Fish show I saw, I was thinking, like, well, I wonder how many people in this room, you know, also saw Dead shows in 73, which that was my first show.
Right.
And it was probably wasn't none, you know, I probably wasn't the only one. But I wonder if it was like 5 or 50, you know?
Right.
And I was thinking about how much has changed in terms of accessing the music, being able to hear what you just heard played,
right.
How you can reach out to other people who share this interest. I mean, all of that stuff has completely changed in the course of my lifetime.
Yeah.
And in some ways for the better and in some ways for the worse.
Right. And these people that immediately post, you know, last time played, whatever, they're able, I know they are, they're able to use like fish.net or you know, dead.net or whatever to get that information quickly and get it out there. And you're right, you know, 20 some years ago or more, that really wasn't an option. Those people had to just have that committed to memory.
That's true. And, you know, something, I know I'm just going down tangents here, but something that struck me the other day was that dead tapes were so hard to get when I was a kid and started collecting them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to know somebody, then if you knew somebody really good, maybe you would get like third or fourth generation tapes. You know, some young people probably don't even know what talking about generations of tapes means.
Right,
you know,
right,
like
right.
That's the number of sort of cassette recorders that would have to be in between you
right.
and the soundboard source or whatever, if you were lucky enough to get soundboards.
Or God forbid there was a tape flip moment when you had to, you know, actually flip the tape. God forbid that happened.
Yeah, exactly. And there were even like certain shows that became famous for having difficult flips, like, yeah, you know, the tapers really had to be on it at the right moment.
Right, right.
You know, but the thing is that the one thing I will say that I miss a bit, and it's kind of, now it's almost irretrievable, this experience, but tapes were so hard to get that if you got a show, a really good show, you would, like, listen to it for weeks. You know, it was like you were absorbing every lesson that could be found in mm-hmm. the choices that the band made and, mm-hmm. You know, the equipment they were using and the song sequence. Like, you would sort of absorb a set of lessons of that show. Mm-hmm. Now it's like it's so easy to get, you know, you went to a show last night, you already have it, you know.
Right, yeah.
I sort of feel like you have much more access to music, but I don't know. You know, I don't want to say, like, these kids today. But, you know, it's like, I don't know if people can really appreciate how intense it was to finally get a hold of some mm-hmm. Show, particularly one that you had sought after and, you know, you tried to find it. Like, I remember, you know, you would occasionally, like, hear of a show. Like, I heard of a show that was played on Cape Cod in, I think it was 1979, mm-hmm. and by the Dead. And my family went to Cape Cod for, like, 40 summers. I didn't go to that show, unfortunately. I wasn't there, but supposedly an epic other one was played, you know. So it was, I was, like, looking for that show for months. And then when I finally went on my first date with the person who is going to become my future husband, mm-hmm. a guy named Keith. In fact, we dated by going on fish tour, mm-hmm. but we can talk about that later. One of the amazing sort of synchronicities of our first date was that he had that Cape Cod tape,
oh, wow.
that I had been looking for years.
Aww.
And, you know, so he popped it on. It was like, oh, my God, this really is amazing.
Right.
So that was a very auspicious sign. But now everybody has everything.
Right. Well, yeah.
So it doesn't matter.
And the fact that later on tonight here that I'm easily able to play The Dark Star Into Morning Dew from 45 years ago today at Winterland, it's amazing. That's just it's just right there.
Yeah, and I do want to give a special shout out to people like Charlie Miller, who ensures that archive.org yeah. has the best possible sound quality. These people are really, like, kind of saints of the scene,
right.
making sure that this enormous body of music goes down to later generations from now in the best possible shape with as much information about the music as possible.
Yeah.
And so thank you guys for doing all that work out there.
Right. And you know, the radio stations, the broadcasters, we love them, obviously, as well, for, you know, being able to give us that material to play for you guys. So, all right.
Sure.
So, Steve, we have successfully broken the ice. I think we melted it here. I want to talk about the early days of Steve Silberman, your childhood growing up. You grew up at a pretty pivotal time for the country. What were your early musical interests growing up at that time?
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, by the way, I want to say, when you sent me a layout of the possible questions you might ask me,
uh-huh.
what's funny is that even though I have been interviewed hundreds of times, I'm sure, usually because of a book that I wrote about the history of autism called Neurotribes,
right.
nobody has ever asked me about my early musical influences. So this is new territory for me, and it's very exciting.
Awesome.
Well, basically, my story is that I grew up in a communist household. My parents were communists, and they were very into unions and being against nuclear testing in the early 60s, and they were into folk music, and my mom was, she looked a lot like AOC, Ocasio-Cortez.
Uh-huh.
She was like this beautiful, dark-eyed, very intensely committed woman who uh-huh. was not just political, but she ran for Congress, actually, when I was in, like, fifth grade or so. She didn't make it in.
Uh-huh.
But her platform, which was considered incredibly, you know, dangerously radical at the time,
right.
was that we should pull out of Vietnam. We should pull our forces out of Vietnam. Of course, a couple years later, everybody was saying that.
Right.
But at the time, she was very on the leading edge of politics. So I grew up kind of in the middle of the 60s, mm-hmm. but too young to have been like a hippie myself.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I had an oddly, you know, kind of almost uncanny experience when I was little that really predicted a lot of my future.
Mm-hmm.
I was growing up in Queens in New York City, and this was way before Queens was cool. I hear it's cool now. So I grew up in a sort of residential neighborhood called Fresh Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a planned community. And one day I walked outside to our backyard behind our building, and there were a bunch of, well, they seemed like adults to me, but they were probably like teenagers, more or less. And they were like lying around on a blanket and having fun. And so I hung out with them all that day, and they seemed really funny and sweet. And, you know, now I know they were completely tripping on acid. And in fact, they were still there the next day.
Wow.
And so we all had a good time, like looking through Life magazine and, laughing at the kind of straight culture, you know, pictures of LBJ or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was amazing that they had stayed the night on their blanket, like behind our building.
Yeah.
And I remember they were cutting leaves out of colored paper and taping it in the trees and all this. So anyway, and that, you know, they kept referring to, oh yeah, I took a half, you know, and I didn't quite know what they were talking about. I was probably about nine,
uh-huh.
but I kind of knew that, you know, it was probably something like drugs.
Right.
And at the end of the day, believe it or not, I brought them up to meet my parents because my parents were kind of young and hip, and they weren't hippies. They were more like button-down new leftists, but mm-hmm. I thought, you know, they might all get along, and they pretty much did. And before they left, I asked them, where are you guys from? And one of the women in the group said, we're from a place you'll never see, the Haight-Ashbury.
Oh, wow.
Now, I had no idea what she was talking about. Right. I mean, I might have heard of the Haight, but,
right.
you know, like, I didn't know what she meant by a place you'll never see. Well, you know, by now I've lived in the Haight-Ashbury for 40 years, you know, so that comment actually, you know, made a deep impression on me.
Right.
But in another way, I think she was right. You know, I never did see the place where they came from, the Haight, as it was then,
right.
when it was still, you know, relatively unspoiled, I guess, or was just about to be spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the Haight that I've lived in has been wonderful, and I still love the neighborhood, actually, but it's not at all like it was in 65, mm-hmm. you know, when the dead were hanging out here and whatnot.
Right.
But so that, you know, I kind of was a counterculture person as a child because my family was countercultural.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they were listening to at home was like Woody Guthrie records.
Nice.
and Pete Seeger records.
Right.
And so it was that kind of stuff that that guy I mentioned earlier, Jesse Darnow, he just wrote a book about the Weavers. And the Weavers was another group that my parents liked. And so it was kind of, you know, lefty workers, you know,
uh-huh.
workers folk music or something like that.
Right.
Was the first records that I heard played in my house. And then the first album that I ever bought with my own money was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's Deja Vu. I remember buying, if there are any New Yorkers out there listening, I remember buying it at E.J. Corvette's on Long Island because we were, you know, in Queens.
Uh-huh.
And I remember like trying to decide which record to buy, and oh, this one seemed cool. And if anybody remembers, the original pressings of Deja Vu had a kind of a marbled texture in the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And little did I know that at least, you know, one of the people who made that record would end up becoming one of my best friends.
Right.
Many years later.
Right.
But that was really that album had a huge effect on me. And, you know, I would say probably the earliest the very first music that really struck me was maybe like Creedence Clearwater Revival's Proud Mary, that was on the radio a lot. Melanie's Candle in the Rain or something. I mean, by now I'm like sounding like an old person in a nursing home. But, you know, it was like that, that kind of like freaky. Oh, there was another one that actually, there was another song that Fish covered. What the heck was it? Ride, Captain, Ride.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love
I loved that. Yeah. That, I mean, that song is like magic.
Right.
To me. And so when Fish started covering it, it was just like, oh, my God. You know, it was another, like, Fish synchronicity, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that was the earliest music. And then once I started really getting into stuff, it was stuff like Crosby, Stills, and Nash and the Grateful Dead that got me.
So growing up during that period, the 60s, the 70s, as a gay man, did you encounter any struggles? It sounds like having a rather liberal family was probably beneficial for you. But did you have like issues at school and around town and you know?
Oh, I had issues at home.
Really?
You know, so much has changed in that around that issue.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, yes, my parents were liberal. Yes, they were anti-racist. Yes, they were anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
But they were also homophobic.
Oh.
And I remember, you know, like my father calling one of the administrators at a college that he taught a dyke, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so, in a way, my parents were gay-friendly when we went up to Provincetown every summer.
Right.
There was a couple named Hazel and Alice that owned the house that we rented every summer, and we loved them. But in terms of my sexuality or homosexuality in general, my parents were very against it, actually. Mm. And in fact, when I first came out to them, which was in, I think, it must have been like 9th or 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was they noticed that I was sort of obviously in love with a really close friend of mine. Which is not, by the way, an unusual situation for me to be in. But, so I had this crush on this guy named Mark,
uh-huh,
who gave me, this wonderful box on my birthday one year that had a bunch of like beautiful leaves and stones and stuff. He was an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So he looked at the world with an artist's eyes. And it also had in it Blows Against the Empire, the amazing album by Paul Kantner and Grace Slick that also had Jerry and Mickey and Crosby and Nash and, you know, everybody under the sun on it, the so-called Tarot, Planet Earth Rock and Roll Orchestra, you know, loose mm-hmm. grouping of people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they noticed that whenever Mark called, I was either really happy and I, like, ran out to meet him, you know, like to take a bike ride to his house or mm-hmm. whatever, or, you know, he was not available, and I was really sad and felt rejected or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mom finally asked me one day, like, are you having any problems with girls?
Mm-hmm.
And I told her the truth. No. And she said, are you having any problems with boys? And by that point, you know, I thought, well,
right,
you know, I might as well tell her the
right,
truth.
Right.
So I told her that I was bisexual, which was perhaps slightly stretching the truth, but, you know. I asked her not to tell my father because I knew my father would react badly. And, in fact, he did react badly.
Huh.
And they actually sent me to a therapist for the cure.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, this was when homosexuality was considered a mental illness.
Wow.
So you could be, you know, if you were found holding your boyfriend's hand or something, you could be booked into a mental asylum.
Oh, my.
Like, literally.
Wow.
You were literally breaking the law.
Right.
By being gay. And so I remember finally I went to my first gay pride parade probably when I was like about 12 or something or, you know, in high school anyway.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I went to, you know, Christopher Street in New York City near where the Stonewall riots had happened. And I saw two long hairs holding hands and walking down the street. And the only gay people I'd ever seen up to that point, outside of Provincetown anyway,
mm-hmm.
Were, you know, it's like if they were on talk shows, they would have masks or their faces would be blacked out or whatever. So, you know, you didn't know who they were.
Wow.
So to see two you know, beautiful hippies holding hands and walking down Christopher Street together, I just lost it. I completely wept.
Right.
And, you know, in a way, it's like I ended up becoming that kind of a person, like sort of a hippie, but also gay.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to tell you how much I really appreciate you telling us that story here on the show. That was amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a story. So you moved to San Francisco in 1979, and one of the three factors that you've said was so that you could live a gay life without fear. Was moving away from your parents, was that part of it?
Yeah, it wasn't so much that, because by then I'd already been to Oberlin College, which is like everybody's gay at Oberlin for about 4 years. So, you know, I was fully accepting of myself, but what was going on at that point was, I wasn't really talking about it with my parents much. They did eventually come around and were eventually amazing and completely supported me and came to my wedding with my husband and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the messages that I have for people is that, you know, if you're a young gay person, even if your parents seem very disapproving, they may evolve, and just be yourself. So, yeah, I moved out here to the Hate for basically, you know, kind of two or three reasons. Like, one of them was that I wanted to be gay. And, you know, 79 was before AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost the height of kind of gay liberation, at least that particular flavor of liberation, which involved, you know, people having sex a lot. But it was, you know, kind of like a party. And in fact, one thing that I remember that is almost forgotten now is that there's a bar out here called The Stud that I think is still going, although I haven't been there in 25 years. But after Dead shows, The Stud would be packed with deadheads who just didn't want to stop dancing.
Aww.
And so it had been Janis Joplin's favorite gay bar.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a very mixed and very friendly to everyone bar.
Right.
And, you know, that was for me. Like, that, you know, that's where I went when I went to gay bars. Another reason why I moved out here was the Dead.
Yeah.
Because it was not only Dead shows that I could see a lot, all the time, really, but, you know, Jerry Garcia Band used to play here, like, really almost like it seemed like once a month,
right,
or, you know, three times a month. And you could just, you know, take BART over to Berkeley, sit on the sidewalk outside of the Keystone Berkeley all afternoon, partly so you could get a good standing place, but also partly because it was fun,
because
you could hang out with all the deadheads. And then, you know, Garcia would literally, like, walk. There was no, like, backstage at the Keystone. Garcia would literally walk through the room with his guitar, and people would be, like, patting him on the back. And it was just a wonderful, very informal scene that happened all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I felt like if you were a deadhead, like, you would just eventually move here,
because
it was too good, you know? And so every year, you know, eventually there would be shows at the Greek and the Frost, and we used to call them the High Holy Days, actually. So it, you know, it kind of structured your year,
mm-hmm,
and you could see Garcia Band all the time in between. So it was just a wonderful time to be a deadhead. Then also I came out here because I had learned how to meditate while attending classes in poetry with Allen Ginsberg and a bunch of other great poets like Gregory Corso and writer William Burroughs, a place called Naropa Institute in Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned how to meditate there, and there was a Zen center out here,
mm-hmm,
that was kind of having its own golden age. And so, you know, those were really good reasons for being out here, as well as in the back of my mind, that comment about the Haight-Ashbury that I never forgot.
Right. So when you first rolled in there, tell me about like your first place. And it sounds like obviously you didn't have a problem making friends and getting yourself out there. So when you first got there, what were your first impressions?
Well, it seemed like a magical place. The air smelled like eucalyptus. There were still kind of original hippies around. The Hate was, you know, had been through a lot.
Right.
You know, the Hate had sort of had its apocalypse almost. you know, starting in 1970 or so, of bad drugs and whatnot. So the hate was kind of, you know, had seen better days. But there was still a lot of countercultural stuff going on, and it was still a relatively inexpensive place to live. Mm-hmm. I am now going to shock your listeners by telling them what rent I paid when I first moved to San Francisco.
Oh, God. All right.
I shared an apartment in prime Haight-Ashbury at Page and Central with a garden, overlooking a garden, and just a lovely apartment. I shared that apartment with a roommate who's still a really good friend of mine. Uh-huh. We each paid $100
a
month.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It was like practically like having a subsidy,
Holy.
You know? And so I remember, like, I would be a waiter in a restaurant for like 3 months,
right,
and then go to Europe for 2 months. You know, like, it was ideal for a kind of a, you know, bohemian poet, which,
right,
I guess I was at the time. You know, now, of course, like, the, you know, my husband and I are lucky to split a, you know, something over 3,000 rent for not much more space.
Tell me about that first place. How does that first place of yours, how does it look now? Do you see it often?
Oh, it's still there. Yeah. You know, I'm sure the people are paying $5,000 for the apartment or whatever.
Right.
You know, I still walk by it every now and then.
Yeah.
But what was great about that was that place was wonderful for a young deadhead. For one thing, the post office, where everybody would line up with their index cards on mail-in day. I mean, now I'm talking about ancient deadhead history, but, you know, there'd be a day when you'd have to mail in, you know, for your tickets, and you had to do it in a certain envelope, mm-hmm, and a certain, you know, certain postcard, and
right,
people would decorate their cars and everything. That was like 3 blocks away.
Oh, yeah.
So, the neighborhood was filled with deadheads.
That's awesome. So yes, the Grateful Dead obviously was a big draw for you to move out there. Tell me about how you first heard of the Grateful Dead, and what was your initial impression? How old were you when you first heard the Grateful Dead?
Well, the very first Dead show I ever saw was Watkins Glen. So this was in 1973. It was a festival called the Summer Jam that was the Allman Brothers, the band, and the Dead.
Right.
And I'd be lying if I said that I went there specifically to see the Dead. I wasn't. I think I was more into the Allman Brothers at the time or something.
Yeah.
But for one thing, my friend who I was supposed to go with dropped out the night before, but that wasn't going to keep me from going, so I went by myself.
Mm-hmm.
I lost all my stuff, like my sleeping bag and whatnot, like my first night there.
Oh, wow.
So I was kind of a mess. I think I was 14. There were these bags of, they were called Boda bags. They were like, you know, suede bags filled with wine and whatnot. And they were, I'm sure, totally dosed.
Uh-huh.
And that was pretty much all the water there was, you know.
Well, so what is it with Watkins Glen and having water issues? You know, ever since back then, man, the water issues at Watkins Glen, that's...
Yeah, I know. No, it's a thing. Here's the secret that nobody ever tells you about Watkins Glen, although I've said it, I think, in writing.
Mm.
The scene on the ground was kind of a huge drag. Like, there was nowhere to pee. It was mob. Like, you know, if you wanted to try to find a bathroom, you'd lose your space. It was really crowded. But I will tell you the kind of the most, luminous little weird moment that I had there, pretty much, was at some point I really did have to pee, and I could no longer, like, stand in the middle of this crowd.
Right.
And so, and plus I was dosed to my eyeballs, so I, you know, I'm like wandering around, I'm 14, I don't know what acid is, I don't know who the Dead are, I don't know who I am anymore. So I'm wandering around, and I walk up towards a cliff overlooking the Glen.
Uh-huh.
So it was a cliff where there were all these cars lined up. It was like a lover's leap, like the local couples had come there to make out,
right,
with a view of this concert. And there was a radio station. I don't know if it was pirate radio or just local radio. I've always wondered what happened to these tapes.
Mm.
But there was some kind of radio station was broadcasting the show live. And the Dead had, you know, this kind of complicated system of speakers with staggered groups of speakers so that it sounded good even far away and everything. But what was unusual was that I was far enough away from the actual stage that the sound was taking a while to travel to where I was, but it was quicker when coming through the car radios on the Lover's Leap because, you know, radio waves travel at the speed of light or whatever.
Right.
So the music was actually coming out of the cars, and then I would hear this echo from the stage.
Oh, my God.
So that was really bizarre.
Yeah, especially when you're 14 years old and tripping and having to piss, and you got this going on at the same time. Good Lord, I can't imagine what you're going through.
You know, it was amazing. But the thing is, you know, I didn't know what I was seeing.
Uh-huh.
I made up for that later, or tried to make up for that later, because, you know, I discovered that the Watkins Glen soundcheck was not just good, but one of the best pieces of standalone music that, you know, the Dead ever played in their entire 30-year career. And it's also unlike anything else in their oeuvre. Like, there's, you know, it's not even a riff on known melodic structures. It's like a completely spontaneous suite of music.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tried to do when I was eventually hired to help put together the box set called So Many Roads, I made sure that that piece of music was on that box set because, A, it was so good. B, by that point, I knew the Dead's vault guy, Dick Latvala. He ended up becoming a really good friend of mine. He was a real sweetie. I really miss him, actually. And he told me that, well, you know, the thing about the Watkins Glen soundcheck is because the show itself the following day was, in, at least in Dick's mind, not that great. I actually have come to disagree with him in that regard. I actually think that the Watkins Glen show itself, the day after the soundcheck, is very underrated and should be considered for a vault release at some point. But so I made sure that that was on So Many Roads because I knew that it was virtually the only chance that that it would ever get out on a vault release. And then the second show that I saw was 8674. I kind of lucked out. It was like the first two shows that I ever saw were both, you know, now kind of famously some of the best music that the Dead ever played. So I went to Roosevelt Stadium in 8674, Jersey City, saw them. Unbelievable show. It was one of those long standalone Scarlets before it went into Fire. It was just an awesome show. And I remember in particular, and I tell this story in the documentary on Amazon Prime about the Dead called Long Strange Trip, but I remember that the moment that Phil takes a bass lead in Eyes of the World, like I had never heard, you know, I'd never heard any music like that sounded like that.
Right.
And plus they had the quad speakers going, so it was like you could practically feel the notes in your body, you know. And so that was when I think of the moment that I became a Deadhead, it was the moment in 8674 that Phil started taking a bass lead, and it was like still the first set. It was like the third song or whatever, you know. I mean, one of the things that I liked about the Dead way back then was that it was kind of before the first set, second set dichotomy, you know, came up. And so, for instance, I heard about, I haven't heard it yet, but I heard about the Yem opener, you know, in Mexico the other night. And the Dead used to do more stuff like that, where, you know, where they would play like Eyes in the first set or whatever.
Right.
And so that was the moment that I became a Deadhead.
Tell me about November 20th, 1978 at the Cleveland Music Hall. You pointed that show out in our conversation earlier. Amazing set list, 1978. A great year. Of course, 77, I think people put on a pedestal, but 78 coming off of a great year. And yeah, it's just an amazing set list. Tell me about that show, what you remember from it there at the Cleveland Music Hall.
Well, here's the thing. I'll be very blunt. There was an exceptional batch of acid that came out right, you know, before that tour. I believe it was called, it was either Red Dragon or Green Dragon. There were sort of successive waves of acid. And it was just like it was the stuff, you know, like if you like that kind of thing, that was the kind of thing you like, you know. And so it was very, very good acid. And probably 100 friends of mine from Oberlin, because we were all, there was like a big Deadhead scene at Oberlin College where eventually actually Garcia came and played in the Finney Chapel, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Another soundboard I've never seen, unfortunately. But so we all went up to Cleveland Music Hall, which was a relatively small venue. And first set was very, very good. But then the second set was just beyond belief, because what they did, it was very unusual second set.
Yeah.
Like almost singular. If you look down the list, you'll see it like opens up with like drums jam or something. It's not really drums, but it's more like it opens up with a jam into like Jack a Row.
Right.
You know? But the thing that really got me, there's another extraordinary thing about that set, which I'll mention in a moment, but the thing that really got me about that show was that, for one thing, when they came out for the jam, it was like it wasn't even like a traditional beginning of a set at a concert where, you know, they come out, there's a big, you know, there's big applause, they play some, you know, big hit or whatever. These guys just literally like wandered out on stage. It was like, it was kind of like everybody in the room was equal in a way. It was like we were all at a party, but these guys happen to have guitars in their hands or something. Yeah. So they walk out on stage, they just start playing. Like, you can hear it on the tape. Like, they just kind of go into the jamming.
Yeah.
And what they did was they linked all the songs that they played in that set, which included, like, Shakedown and Playin' and whatnot, with jams.
Yeah.
And so it was as if they kept sort of dipping, you know, they'd come out of the water for a minute, you know, play a song, and then go back into the ocean of jamming. And it was absolutely unbelievable. And then that night the Dead played If I Had the World to Give. Mm-hmm. I think they only played it like 3 times in their whole career or something live. And it was definitely the best one, because after the jam afterwards is absolutely apocalyptic.
Yeah.
It's completely mind-blowing. Bob is doing things with his slide. Jerry is, fanning, as they used to say, where he's strumming very quickly.
Right.
And, it sounds like a supernova collapsing on itself by the end of it. And then they go right into the playing, right back into playing, and not even like a big moment in playing. They just sort of go back into the middle of the jam. And I listened to that tape a million times, and it's kind of a shame because the tape itself is a little bit, it's been patched and everything, and so it's not the best tape ever.
Yeah.
But it is easily one of the best performances ever, and nobody else did that kind of music. Miles Davis kind of did on his summer tour of Europe in 1967. I've looked for this stuff, you know. It was like, I was one of those people who used to say, well, the Dead were influenced by jazz players like Miles Davis.
Right.
Yes, they were, but even Miles didn't do that.
Right.
Tell
me, you obviously had a litany of amazing Grateful Dead experiences. A lot of people have said that they've had, you know, religious or spiritual experiences with the Dead. Did you have anything that was could be considered spiritual, mind-blowing, that just really changed your life with the Dead?
Yeah, every time or something? Yeah.
Yeah,
I did. I mean, here's the thing. You know, it's almost too easy to talk about this stuff, and it's easy to be very sloppy talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, I will be very crisp and clear. I don't have a standard view of whether or not God exists or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think evolution is fascinating. If we worship anything, evolution is good enough, you know. But the one thing I will say is that I regularly had experiences of kind of transcendence of, you know, rising out of the dust of the worries of daily life, having the feeling like you were having a cosmic perspective on your life and your life problems. I would come back from shows kind of knowing what to do about a situation, because it was as if my compass had been tuned back to true north mm-hmm. by the experience of seeing the band. You know, it wasn't like I wasn't like getting something from Jerry. Like I don't project, you know, like that. But mm-hmm. there was something about the whole scene, the band, the music, the fans, the drugs sometimes, what you could do with sober. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be a check-in with the deepest levels of myself. And that's why it was so valuable, and that's why I so miss it now, because I feel like I've sort of been, you know, I've been traveling without a compass
right.
for, you know, decades by now, sadly. But Fish, you know, can do it too occasionally. Keith and I, my husband and I, had great times at Baker's Dozen, and, you know, Fish can definitely get way down into the deep, intense place in the same way that the Dead could. And that's why I go see Fish, really, are those exploratory, open-ended, you know, people, probably the worst mistake that people make when they talk about jam bands is thinking that it's all like sweetness and light or something.
Right, right.
No.
You know, yeah.
When, Carini is yeah. not all sweetness and light.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
It's dark. And I feel like that darkness actually gives the music transformative potential.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like you can bring your life problems to it, and sometimes you'll get an answer.
Right.
You know?
Some of my more spiritual, you know, if I want to say spiritual moments when seeing Fish have been during some of those dark, evil moments where it's just like, yeah, everything that's just been pent up and you know, bugging me, it's just let go when Fish is up there summoning Satan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I saw, you know, a couple of shows ago, I saw somebody wearing a Make Fish Evil Again
yeah,
hat,
yeah,
you know, and
yeah.
I told him I thought it was one of the best hats I'd ever seen.
Right.
And that's the thing that I think people do not understand about jam bands from the outside. And in fact, I'll go so far as to say some jam bands don't even understand it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they try to stay too positive, really,
right,
you know.
Right, yeah.
But I feel like if you're really committing yourself to going, you know, allowing the music to play the band, as
yeah.
Bob Weir sang, that you'll end up in dark places because that's part of the human experience.
Exactly.
And so I can't say that I ever had the experience of, like, Jesus walking out of the wall of sound. And, you know, you know, I didn't have, like, that kind of religious experience. But
mm-hmm.
I had experiences where I felt I had kind of two kinds of experience that might be called spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I would feel like I had checked in with the deepest levels of not just myself, but the universe kind of at shows. The other thing is that I had a feeling at certain shows, which many Deadheads, you know, say they've also had,
mm-hmm.
where the band would almost evoke a kind of a beast, you know, with many, many hands, you know, that would be playing through the sound system. It was like this beast entered the room. And Fish can definitely do that.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely seen them do that. And that is amazing. I mean, they're, you know, when you start to hear like more than three musicians, you know, playing,
right,
like,
right.
That's pretty interesting, you know? And so I feel like they're, that people like the Dead and Fish are so good at what they do and so good at attaining temporary mind melds, you know, that they can evoke something that is larger than the musicians on stage. And that is really something.
Did you ever meet Jerry?
Yeah, I did meet Jerry. Only twice, really. And I really only got to talk to him for about half an hour once. It was a great experience, actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think it was the late 80s or something, and the Dead had released a video called So Far, and I got invited to the press screening, and it was on Market Street in San Francisco, which is kind of a grungy, you know, place.
Uh-huh.
And so I got there like half an hour early, and I thought, well, should I go in or should I like just go kill time? Oh, I'll go in. So I walk in the door. There's nobody there except Jerry sitting at a table rolling a joint, you know? So I thought, like, well, I don't want to bum him out, you know? And he looked up at me, and he just sort of shrugged and, you know, like, looked at the seat across from him, like, why don't you join me?
Oh, wow.
So that was great, you know? And we ended up smoking and talking, and he was just who you would have wanted him to be. Mm. He was very, very smart. He was very, very sweet. He had a wide range of cultural references. Like, Jerry was an intellectual, self-taught mostly, but he knew a lot about cinema and art and writing and literature. He'd been a big fan of the Beat Generation writers like Ginsberg and Kerouac. Mm-hmm. And so we had plenty to talk about. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was this kind of lovely moment afterwards. I talked to him also at the end, and there were these press people there who, you know, wanted to take his picture and stuff. And so at some point, like, Dennis McNally, their press guy, you know, had to drag him away. And so he looked at me, and he gave me this really goofy smile, and then he shrugged, like, sorry, man, I'm famous. I got to do this BS, you know?
Right.
And then he threw his arms around me.
Oh, wow.
And gave me a huge hug. And I smelled his beard, you know, which smelled like cigarettes and pot.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he was just a sweetheart. And it wasn't like, you know, I hugged a lot of guys. And some guys are really good huggers and others not so much. And he definitely was. Like, he was fully there for that hug, which was so nice because I had basically grown up standing in front of him, you know, more or less.
Amazing.
I'd spent hundreds of nights, you know, by that point, standing in front of him. So to have him be that sweet and that open and that willing to talk was just a really beautiful experience.
Yeah.
Sadly, you know, a few years later, I saw him backstage. Like, I wrote a book with a guy named David Schenck called Skeleton Key, A Dictionary for Deadheads, in the early 90s. And after that book came out, I got sort of passes to, you know, backstage passes to shows. But Jerry was, you know, inaccessible.
Mm.
He was too wasted. And, you know, the saddest thing on earth was seeing this guy who had been so sociable and so engaged and so funny. And like, I remember when I'd been talking to him around that video thing, I remember I forgot that it was Jerry. Like, it's, you know, I was high, you know, but I forgot that it was Jerry for like a moment. And I thought to myself, God, this guy is really hip. And it was like, of course he's hip. It's Jerry Garcia. You know?
Right.
Why do you think you've been going to see him all this time?
Right.
You know? So, but so I see him backstage, you know, in the 90s, and, you know, he was a mess, and he was very isolated.
Mm.
And that's something that you can see while watching the documentary Long Strange Trip, how isolated he became. And, you know, I don't want to like lay a big trip on people for idolizing him. I mean, I know how that was. I idolized him myself in a way, but, it's just one of those difficult things about fame. And it's also one of those difficult things about heroin, was that it completely isolates you. And to see someone who is so, you know, I mean, I assume similar things happened with Trey during his bad period, where people who must have seen him being, you know, friendly and happy earlier then saw him just being kind of out of it.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of sad that Jerry never got to do what Trey did, which was to recover and then reinvent himself.
Right. You sent me some interesting audio earlier today that I'm going to play after our interview here, because we're on a time crunch. But can you tell me about it real quick, the wall song that you sent me, speaking of the...
Yeah, sure. Boy, this time has really flown, I must say. But yeah. Okay, so the long and the short of it is... I became a David Crosby tape collector, fanatic, you know, and then I eventually met them when they were putting together a CSN box set in the early 90s. I then turned David on to the internet, I got him online. He loved it.
No. And so wait a minute. We have you to blame for his Twitter account. No.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Totally. I was calling a friend of mine and I heard a phone ring in the background and I said, "Do you have to get that?" And he said, "Oh no, it's just David Crosby. He's a fax addict." And I said, "Fax addict? Does he have email?" and he didn't, you know. So I got him email, and you know. Anyway, the long and the short of it is we're very, very good friends now. And so at this point in what you're going to play, the Wall song was a song that David wrote in amid a bunch of songs, circa like 68 or so, like right after he had spent a couple months making love to Joni Mitchell on sailboat the Mayan around the waters of Florida, and they both exchanged open tunings and weird alchemical chords and stuff. And so David's music was so good at that point that his producer Stephen Barnhart called the batch of songs that he wrote then a sky drop. Like that's how good they were. And so one of the songs that he wrote was a song called the Wall Song. And so there are early versions of the Wall Song going back a long time, and there are some later versions. There's a version recorded at Mickey's Barn with members of the Dead and whatnot. But what this is, what you're going to play, is it's very rare. It's the master take of the Wall Song from an album called Graham Nash and David Crosby. The master take was released, but it fades out before the jam. Mm-hmm. begins, and for anybody who's into the Dead, the jam is unbelievable because it's a period when the Dead, I don't know if they ever played it outside of Mickey's Barn, really. It's like it's a rare performance in general. Mm-hmm. But just hear a studio jam that goes all the way out there. The only comparable thing is the version of Playing in the Band from Bob Weir's Ace album, which is, also wonderful. But so this is David, Graham Nash on piano, Phil Lesh on bass. I'm pretty sure it's Billy on drums. No Weir, Jerry on guitar, obviously. The vocal is not that good because it's what's called a scratch vocal. So mm-hmm. it's just a rough vocal. The vocal on the take that was released on the album is better. But the jam is just beyond belief.
Excellent. We're going to play that coming up here after the interview in about 25 minutes or so. So, David Crosby, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, another reason why you moved to San Francisco, and like you said earlier, you and David Crosby have become great friends since then. What's that like, and what is it like, what is David like and being friends with him? And
Here's the thing. I would say that most of what people think about David Crosby is wrong. in that, he was a terrible dude, in the 80s mm-hmm. when he was frying on cocaine and mm-hmm. freebase. And he had terrible, he had terrible influences and terrible friends, and he went to jail and, but, David sort of got this reputation of being sort of an egotistical asshole at the time. Mm-hmm. He's actually, now that he's, I don't want to call him sober because he does like to smoke pot, and he talks about that. Mm-hmm. But he's incredibly sweet, and a really amazing thing has happened with David in the last few years, which is absolutely a joyful experience for me, and that is, when I started seeing David, it was in the 70s, then the 80s were pretty good. He was playing with Nash and a sort of a Crosby Nash band with people like David Lindley. That was all good. Then in the 90s, he went, kind of down this sewer with cocaine. Mm-hmm. His music got terrible. He was playing these kind of reunion shows with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It was like Madame Tussaud's House of Woodstock. Like, the shows were awful, really. Right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Everybody loved him. The boomers dug it, But his music was not growing. And so I would always encourage him to sort of get back into his own music. And he eventually formed a band called CPR for Crosby, Pivar, Raymond, mm-hmm. James Raymond being his son, who he gave up for adoption when he was a young man, and then found, or James found him mm-hmm. later, and they had this amazing reunion right when David was about to get a liver transplant. And Jeff Pivar is a wonderful guitar player who played in a band called Jazz is Dead that did jazz covers of the Dead.
Yeah.
Anyway, CPR was an awesome band, and it was in that band that David's sort of songwriting urge woke up again, really, mm-hmm. and he became prolific again. Mm-hmm. But the mind-blowing thing that's happened in the last, really, just 4 years, he has made an album every year for the last 4 years, and not only are they good, they're great, and not only are they great, they're not like his early music,
right?
Except in good ways.
Yeah.
So it's like it has the same, you know, haunting quality and gorgeous harmonies, but he's linked up with young, incredible players like Michael League of Snarky Puppy and Becca Stevens, a great singer-songwriter, and Michelle Willis, another great singer-songwriter. And they kick butt. They're amazing. So his recent four albums are Cross, Here If You Listen, Lighthouse, and I forget the name of the other one, but anyway, they're all great. And I've actually almost gone wild seeing tours by his bands lately, and he's gonna go on another tour this summer. But he's so prolific that he is basically the most prolific and creative member of his generation at this point. Like, you know, Neil Young hasn't put out four albums in the last 4 years right. that are unbelievable. Hardly anybody his age has. You know, James Taylor's still great. He puts out an album like every 5 years now at the most.
Yeah.
David is just kicking butt. And anybody out there who's listening, if you haven't heard David's last four albums, really, check them out.
Yeah, you've got Cross that came out in 2014, Lighthouse in 2016, Sky Trails in 2017, and Here If You Listen last year, October 26, 2018. Yeah, that is amazing that a man, that he's still releasing beautiful music and at that rate.
Yeah, and I'm going to say something else, actually. This is the first time that I've said anything about it, but I think it's okay if I talk about it. There's a new documentary about him mm-hmm. that just came out at Sundance called something like, what is it called? Oh, no. Well, something like, you know, if I could only remember my name, or what the heck is it called? Anyway, I'll look it up.
Yeah, it is Remember
It's
My
a
name.
Great documentary. It's made by a guy named A.J. Eaton and a guy named Cameron Crowe, who is a very famous Rolling Stone writer. Mm-hmm. And it's a really beautiful, deep documentary that does not flinch away from it's called Remember My Name, yeah. David Crosby. Does not flinch away from the bad stuff that happened to David, or the bad stuff that David did mm-hmm. in his earlier life. It reckons with David going back to Kent State, you know, under the Trump administration, which is obviously a very bittersweet experience, mm-hmm. and talking about how the killing of those students affected him and affected the whole band. Mm-hmm. And it's just an absolutely wonderful documentary. So it'll be in theatrical release, I think, this summer mm-hmm. in July, and it's well worth seeing.
Let's talk about Phish. Your first Phish show, 7/18/91, with the giant country horns. And you once said about the Gula Papyrus that was played that night, quote, "I had a premonition that I would never see them in such an intimate venue again." Can you elaborate on that more and what you were feeling at the time?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, you know, it was like when I first heard about Phish, it was when they were playing the Wetlands, mm-hmm. you know, and I saw the name, you know, and I thought, really? Phish with a PH? Really? You know, I had like this very, you know, shallow, and plus also I had been, you know, a deadhead for so long. I had this kind of, you know, pretentious, oh, well, surely there are no Grateful Dead.
Right, right.
But I kept hearing, you know, you got to go see Steve. You got to go see them. you got to go see them, you know. So when they came to the Great American Music Hall out here in San Francisco, where, of course, the Dead had played one of the greatest shows of their career in 75, mm-hmm. I thought, okay, what the hell? I'll finally go. And it was during Gula Papyrus that, you know, it sort of hit me like a sledgehammer. These guys are freaking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were so completely well-rehearsed, so professional, so lyrical in their playing. They told stories with their instruments just like the Dead did. They seemed like fun guys. You know, I thought to myself during Gula Papyrus at the Great American, I will never see these guys in a small venue again. And that certainly is true. And the next time I saw them was a couple of years later when I met my future husband, Keith Carricker, online. In fact, Keith was at that Great American show.
Mm-hmm.
It was his first Fish show, too. But we didn't meet. You know, if we had met at that Fish show, I could have saved myself two miserable years of loneliness and online dating or something like, you know, online dating was just starting back then.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so we ended up doing a bunch of shows.
Wait a
really.
Minute. I'm confused for a second. I'm confused. Your first show was the Great American Music Hall one?
It was. Okay. And then second show was on the same, was it 94 when the Spreckles?
Right, okay. So your first show was 10-18-91, not 7-18-91 then. 7-18-91.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Yes.
I'm sorry. 7-18. Did I send you the wrong date? I might have.
I don't know. 7-18-91 was Hampton Beach. But you also did send, 10-18-91 at Great American Music Hall, which, yes, also had a Gila Papyrus. Okay. And then your second show at Spreckles, December 8th, 1994.
Yeah, I don't know if that, I think there might have been a show on that tour before that I saw.
Uh-huh.
But the next show that really made an impression on me was that Spreckles show with Reba.
Yeah.
Reba is still. I mean, it was a hilarious situation because what happened was I met my husband online, or a future husband. You know, we're wondering, like, well, how should we get to know each other? Like, you know, what do we do on dates? We both like this music. He was about to leave on Fish tour.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten an assignment from a newspaper called the San Diego Reader to write about, like, the gay disco revival.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something I wanted to do, but they were paying a lot of money, so I thought, oh, okay, I'll do that. So I went, once I met Keith, I went back to the editor, and I said, forget the gay disco revival. I want to write about this band that's the next Grateful Dead. You know, like, I mean, it was a completely commercial, you know, move on my part, but it worked. And so I ended up interviewing Trey.
Yeah.
Doing a very in-depth interview with Trey. And I remember that I was given the name Fistin Ristenbutt to ask for at the hotel when I interviewed Trey.
Really?
That was his road name.
Wow.
You know, Trey was lovely, and we ended up hanging out with all the guys, and they were really funny. Fishman, I remember we talked about an album by Fripp and Eno called No Pussyfooting.
Uh-huh.
And he said, yeah, man, you know, Swastika Girls, that was the name of one of the tracks on the album.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that album used to scare me. I would, like, put it up on the wall and say, ooh, you know. And so they were, like, hilarious guys. There was not such a division between the band and the audience. You know, I was used to, like, the Dead with their many layers of people in between the audience and the band. Fish was just hanging out.
Yeah.
You know, after the show. And I had a really good interview with Trey. It was recently republished in Dead Bass, actually.
Mm-hmm.
If you look up my name, Steve Silberman, and Trey's name in Dead Bass, you will find that interview. And I've been warned by, like, you know, fishheads who were trying to do me a favor, saying, like, whatever you do, don't mention the Grateful Dead.
Right.
Don't mention the Grateful, you know, do not, you know. And so, of course, you know, I did. And Trey was completely wonderful about it and talked about what had inspired him in the Dead's music and how he used to go see them. And, we had a really good conversation, and I think I, endeared myself to him because I recognized that the way he was using harmonics in Slave to the Traffic Light reminded me of the Pat Metheny group in the 70s, and he dug that I had noticed that, and it was definitely a direct influence because he'd gone to see Pat Metheny. And so, you know, I just loved them, and, you know, I haven't gotten to know them really, but I've certainly been going to shows ever since and planning on going to Dick's.
How many approximately have you seen since your first?
Maybe 100, something like that, over the years. So, I'm not, you know, I'm not a heavyweight or anything. I don't go to every show, but I have a blast. We went to the Gorge this summer. I'd never been there before. It was great. We went to New Year's this year, last year. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. You know, by now I know as many people at Fish shows as I used to know at Dead shows.
Oh yeah, I was going to say being an old school Deadhead. Do you encounter a lot of people like yourself seeing Fish now that may have seen the Dead, you know, back in their earlier days? And what's
not really. Hmm. Like, you know, I know they're out there. Like, I know that, you know, Charlie Miller, for instance, has not only been upgrading tapes for the Dead on Archive, but has also been taping Fish shows and is, I believe, advising them on taping in some ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some of us older Deadheads out there. If anybody's listening and they, you know, they recognize me at a show, like, definitely say hello. That's mm-hmm. great. But it's also really fun to just be with young people. And I don't feel like I have to, you know, like, say, like, well, I saw the Dead. You know, it's like, who cares?
Right.
This is what's happening now. Everybody's having a blast. All ages are dancing together, and that's what I'm there for.
So what are your thoughts on the past, let's say, early 90s, the present now, and then perhaps the future of the Fish community? You talked about evolution earlier. So the evolution of the Fish community from the early 90s through now, and what type of predictions, if any, do you have for the future of the Fish community, and as well as the Dead community?
Well, you know, I mean, one thing about the Fish community was that it had the example, both positive and negative, of the Deadhead community that they can look at and see, okay, what worked and, you know, what doesn't. And, you know, one of the things that worked was making the music available immediately to fans after they play it, which is great. You know, it's unfortunate that the tickets are so expensive. You know, I certainly miss the days when, you know, shows were $8 or something at the most, really. That was a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, I still feel the same good vibes, the same, you know, basically everybody supporting each other, having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
There are some new twists in not just the Fish community, but sort of concert going now that are not great, like people talking during the jams.
Mm-hmm.
Be quiet. My God, just be quiet. You know, it's like nothing you could possibly say to your buddy is as important as the quiet part of this Reba.
Right.
Just be quiet. Yeah. You know, at one of the nights of the New Year's runs, I happened to be in like the talkers section. And so it was like talking through the whole thing.
And
I didn't get that at all.
I firmly believe that Trey and the whole band is, they've got to be somewhat distracted now. With the talkers and everything, and I think that affects the show. You know, you listen back to those early '90s shows, and they're played so beautifully, and those pauses in Divided Sky, where it is like you could hear a pin drop. You don't get that anymore, and I do feel that affects the band. You think that as well?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I was really happy that there was a very quiet moment in the New Year's run, and Trey played that unbelievably gorgeous acoustic song called Bliss, which was
mm-hmm.
wonderful.
Mm-hmm. That was the first time.
You know, so it is possible to bring the volume down, but I just don't get why people have to behave as if they're in their living room, you know, when they're at a show.
Right.
But I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be like old man yells at cloud.
No, you're not.
You know,
you're not.
I appreciate that, you know, that everybody has their own way of enjoying the music, but it should be quiet, I would say. One thing that is better about the Fish scene than the Dead scene ever was, really, mm-hmm. was its acceptance of gay people. And in fact, I'm going to be speaking at a conference called Queering Psychedelics. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows about this yet.
Damn, you've dropped a lot of stuff here on this show.
What's that?
You've dropped a lot of big stuff on the show here tonight.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, it's because I usually get interviewed about autism, as I was saying, which I can talk about some other time.
Right.
But so, yeah, there's going to be a conference called Queering Psychedelics in San Francisco, and I am going to be talking about coming out as gay in the jam band community. This conference is at June 1st and 2nd in San Francisco.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I mean, as far as I know, it's the first conference presentation on being a gay deadhead, more or less.
Wow.
So when we talk about that, and that's something that there's a group of queer Fish fans called Brian and Robert, mm-hmm. you know, which is a wonderful,
right.
wonderfully apt name. And it's they're the Dead scene, unfortunately, was kind of homophobic, you know, when I was growing up. And eventually a group did march in the San Francisco Gay Pride Parade. In fact, they marched under a banner called Queers for Weir. I marched in that parade, and the most beautiful thing happened, actually, when we were marching, which was that this older man, very good-looking, came running up to us, and he was in tears, and he asked if he could take our picture, and he said that he'd been waiting for this for years, and it turned out to be John McIntyre,
oh, wow.
the former tour manager of the Grateful Dead.
Right. That's amazing.
Yeah, and so he had lived a closeted life
right.
up to that point,
wow.
and it just blew his mind in a great way to see us.
Yeah.
And so now, thank God, you know, people don't have to go through living for decades in the closet like that. And there are lots and lots of queer Fish heads who are just out there and having fun and partying and supporting each other. And that's a great thing.
Yep. We love them all. We love everybody. At least we try to. And, you know, you're right. Sometimes the Fish community, or any community, sometimes there are those that just need to stop hating, you know. It's
yeah.
it's not always about them. All right, so yeah. as you predicted, after I sent you this layout, there's so much that we're not going to be able to cover during our interview here. So let's wrap it up here, because we are approaching the end time here. Another band, I interviewed Joel Cummins yesterday, Humphreys McGee. And he wanted me to personally deliver you a message. They're going to be playing near you, I believe, next weekend. And you are invited to that show. He wants to know if you intend on going to that Humphreys McGee show next weekend. And he wanted me to put you on the spot. So, you know, take your...
No, wait, hold on. Wait a minute. Wait. This is Humphreys McGee?
Yeah.
I'm going.
There you go. All right. So
I'm totally. I was going anyway.
All right. Good. Yeah. Joel.
Wait. Who said this?
Joel Cummins, the keyboard player.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Tell him I love him. Yeah. Tell him my friends and I are going.
All right. We'll do.
So. Yeah. We're psyched to be there. Yeah. Cool. If you
awesome.
Want to send me an email and tell me to, you know, meet him backstage before hang out before the show. Fine.
Sweet. All right.
That's great.
What's coming up next for you? You said you plan on attending Dick's. What else
well,
you got coming
yeah,
up?
Yeah, I'm working on another book. You know, my day job, as it were, my other life, is I'm a medical historian, believe it or not.
Mm.
And my book, Neurotribes, which was a history of autism,
mm-hmm.
Covering 80 years of changing perspectives on the diagnosis and lots of stuff changing in society
mm-hmm.
around the idea of autism and the concept of neurodiversity. So that came out in 2015. It became an international bestseller. It's now in, like, I think, 13 languages or whatever. I will have another book about medical history coming out in about 3 years, and I can't tell you yet what it is, but it'll be news of that book deal will be coming out within the month.
Excellent. And like I said, you mentioned that you plan on attending Dick's this year. So if anybody, you know, sees Steve, recognizes him, I assume you would love it if people came up to you and gave you a big hug.
Yeah, that would be great.
Awesome.
Thanks so much, Andy. It's been really fun to talk to you.
Thank you, man. This has been, yeah, an absolute honor. I really appreciate it. You are extremely interesting. And so like I said, we're going to play this right now. This is Crosby and Nash and the Dead minus Weir, from 1971, their performance of The Wall Song. Steve Silberman, thank you again so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And, we'll keep in touch. All right, man.
Sounds great. Thank you, buddy.
All right. Thank you. Steve Silberman, everybody. All right. So here we go. This is he sent this to me earlier. The jam at the end, The Grateful Dead minus Bobby. Here you go. The Wall Song right here on Jump Radio.
This wall that you've been trying to cross for years, this fence made of fear, no one here. And there's a space like vacuum waiting inside you for you to get are they still dead?